Many years ago, I was part of a delegation of Canadian Baptists who went to El Salvador. And we went to see a joint project that we'd been involved in with people in El Salvador. They were water projects. And it was a partnership between Canadian Baptists who supplied resources and expertise and El Salvadorans who trained and worked and did a lot of the labor to bring water to villages. And we got to go and visit some of the projects that we'd been working on, that they'd been working on. They did most of the work. You see, in the village, one of the villages that we went to early in the morning, the women get up before dawn. These villages are up in the hills, but the water, the spring that their village lives off of, is at the bottom of the hill, mountain, foothill. It's about a half hour walk from the top of the mountain down to where the water is. And they carry jugs. And you see the women walking early in the morning. Women and girls, 9, 10, 11-year-old girls, carrying jugs. And they go down the mountain and they fill the jugs. And then they put the jugs on their heads or on their shoulder. And they walk back up to the village. Now, a gallon of water weighs about 8.5 pounds. So, a 5-gallon pail of water weighs about 40 pounds. 41, I think. And these are small people and young girls and old women. In this village, and the next village, and the next village, and all through El Salvador. But not just El Salvador, I mean all through Central America. What am I saying? All through the world. All through the world. The majority of people in the world, the majority of people in the world, get up and go to find water every day. Every day. And they carry it. And this water that these women would bring back to their village would be the water for the day. It would be enough water to get their family through the day. Donna and I were camping this weekend, and in 3 days we went through that and had to get more. And we were being sparing. They live, their whole family, on that much water or less. And they do that every day. They do it even if they get sick or hurt. And the men, they don't have it any better. From the time they can swing a machete, they're working in the sugarcane fields. Young boys, men, and they work all their lives. And they carry great burdens, not just physically, but the concern and care that they have for their family and for their community. And we got to be part of a small thing where we would help bring a pumping system in that would bring water up to their village so that there would be a garden faucet in the center of the village where they could get the same water. And it changed their lives. That was a good thing. It was a good thing to be part of. But while I was there, I got thinking about a lot of things. I got thinking about how much water I go through without thinking about it. how much water my family uses, how long I will stand in the shower, especially when it's hot. And thinking about how different my life is from their lives. And yet we aren't that different. And one of the things that I got thinking about, even then, was the way those folks lived in that little village in El Salvador that I described. That way they lived was much closer to the way Jesus and the people he knew lived. All over the world, the people that Jesus was talking to 2,000 years ago in Palestine, halfway around the world, had a lifestyle and a way of living that was much more akin to the lives of the people that I met in El Salvador, and much further from the way I live, in all kinds of ways. And it was a good note to make that when Jesus is speaking in the Sermon on the Mount, when he was speaking to people, when he was interacting with people, when he was healing people and talking with people and teaching, he was talking to people who were poor. They were subsistence farmers, subsistence fishermen. They lived from day to day what they could get for the day to survive for the day so that they could get up the next day and do it again. That's how they lived. That's how Jesus lived. And Jesus lived in that kind of world. It's quite different from the world I live in, and you live in. And it's important for us to note that, at least have it in the back of our heads when we listen to his teachings. He was talking to poor people, farmers, shepherds. Shepherds, remember, not the romanticized Christmas greeting card shepherd. Shepherds, but actual sweaty, tired shepherds who had to stay awake all night, because if they didn't, wild animals would eat their stock. And they had to be ready to kill a lion or a bear or a wolf or anything that would go after their flock. Those things skulking around the edge of the flock, trying to pick off the weak, the young, the naive. And so when we read the gospel message, when we read the Sermon on the Mount that we've been studying, we need to be reminded again. That's the context that Jesus is speaking into. And those are the people who are going to be hearing this first. That's the kind of life that they live. And then Jesus picks up, we're about halfway through the Sermon on the Mount now. We were talking about not making a show of our prayer. He talked about that. He talked about not making a show of our spirituality and our fasting and all of these things to be admired by other people, but to do those things with God and to focus on God. And then he begins verse 25. Read along with me, read in your pew Bibles if you wish. Matthew chapter 6, 25 to 34. Jesus speaking, continuing the Sermon on the Mount. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or stow away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown in the fire, will he not much more clothe you? You of little faith. So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. So, may God give us understanding. Is telling people not to worry just cruel? I mean, worry is kind of what we do, right? There's something intrinsically human about worry. We worry a lot. I mean, do animals worry? I don't know. I'm told that dogs can experience anxiety. Maybe that's the same. But do wolves in the wild worry? I don't know. Maybe dogs worrying is just part of that animal being domesticated. They've just spent too much time with humans. Perhaps if animals didn't spend so much time, they wouldn't mimic human traits so much. So what do you worry about? What do I worry about? I worry about the economy, my job, my career. When I was younger, I worried about nuclear war. I remember hearing Albert Einstein was asked how he thought World War III would be fought. And he's accredited with responding this way: I do not know what weapons will be used in World War III, but the war after that will be fought with sticks and stones. But now, we worry about climate change and what kind of world we're leaving to the next generation. Will my kids make better choices than I did? Oh man, will I make better choices than my kids do? Will my spouse give me the love that I need? I worry about my health. Will I die before I'm ready? Will I live too long? Will I make enough to retire, ever? My mom and dad were old when they lived, and when they died, and so were my grandparents. Will I outlive my RRSPs? My stress level. Because telling someone not to worry can be very anxiety-provoking. Lots of us have anxiety about anxiety. It's a stressor, and it can make you sick. Will my kids do the things they should do? Will they have good lives? We live in a changing, political, volatile world. My son pointed out to me this week that I was worrying uselessly about my sermon on don't worry. And he said he felt like the universe was folding back on itself. And it's not that these things are not real. All these things I listed, they're real. They really happen, and they have real consequences in our lives. For anyone who gets caught on the wrong end of any of these issues. So telling someone not to worry, simply doing that, is not helpful. I mean, I hate it when someone tells me not to worry. My wife, Donna, she always says, don't worry about it, whatever it is. And after all these years, 37 years this August, I love you, dear, 37 years, it's still just as irritating when she tells me not to worry. I don't want to be told, don't worry. And yet, I still need to be reminded that almost all of my worries are useless. It's very rare that I spend any energy at all worrying about something that actually makes a difference. Most of my worry is useless. Someone recently pointed out that human beings share 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees. 98% identical, similar with chimpanzees. 2% difference between chimpanzees and human beings in our DNA. That 2% difference in humans is almost entirely our overly large brains. Freakishly big brains compared. And with those brains, we do amazing things. We do art, and we have language, and we make music, and we go to the moon 50 years ago yesterday. Human beings walked on the moon. Unless you're a conspiracy theorist. And we spend our time doing all of these things, but most of what we do with that extra 2% of brain is we worry. That's probably, maybe, the big distinction between human beings and other animals. Human beings worry about everything, a lot. I get it. I've worked and lived among people who are consumed by worry and anxiety, and I fit right in with those people. We're all stressed out about something. And I don't think Jesus is trying to make us just stop worrying. It's not, don't worry, be happy. He's not trying to make us feel safer either. I really think that what Jesus is trying to do in this passage is he's trying to increase our courage by rooting our hearts firmly in God. The verse just before the passage I read, can you put up the first part of that? Yes. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life. Therefore, it begins with therefore. Therefore is there for something. The therefore is there for a reason. It's linking whatever he's saying afterwards with whatever he said before. And what he said just before is this. Listen, no one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and you will despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Therefore, do not worry. Because he's saying to us, serve God. Focus on God. Make God the focus of your intention. Not money. Now, why money? What's money? And why would he contrast those two? I mean, money is just a measure based on supply and demand of the relative value of particular goods and services. I looked that up. A measure based on supply and demand of the relative value of particular goods and services. That's why Lady Gaga gets paid more for singing a song than I would. And that's why it should be. Because more people are going to want to listen to her sing than are going to want to listen to me sing. I would rather listen to her sing than listen to me sing. Money is also a measure of something else. Money is the measure of the confidence that we place in the system that upholds all of those exchanges. The confidence we have in our governments. The confidence in Jesus' day that people had in the Roman Empire and the image of Caesar on the coins. That felt pretty secure for a lot of people, and it felt like a good investment. And that was what propped up the economy, and that's what people were buying into because they thought that would give them the security that they longed for. Henry Nouwen, he talks about the difference between wishing for things and hoping for things. He talks about how we wish for things, and a lot of our worries, I think, get tied up in things that we wish for. I wish I had a better house. I wish I had air conditioning in my home. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. I wish I had. And Henry says this. Hope has something to do with a promise. There can be no hope without a promise. God says, I will fulfill the deepest needs of your heart. I have given you a restless heart so that I can give you what you need. You can only hope if what you hope for has already touched you. I desire that of which I know a little something. The mystery of hope. Something needs to be fulfilled, but it has already touched you. If you live with hope, you can live in the present because you can nurture the footprints of God in your life. You have a sense of what's to come. The whole of the spiritual life is saying God is right with us now so that we can wait for his coming. The spiritual life is recognizing that God is with us now so that we can wait for his coming. And the waiting with hope, what we're waiting for is already at work within us. We live in a world that doesn't know hope. We know wishes. Christmas. A wish. I wish for this thing and I wish for that thing. It's all very concrete. A new job. A better house. But hope is a living thing. I don't know how God will fulfill his promise, but I know he will. And therefore, I can live in the present with the knowledge of God being with me and hoping and trusting that the deepest desires of my being will be fulfilled. It keeps the future very open. It's not a controlling thing. It's a way of living. I don't need to control my future. I want to have hold of my future. There's something in me that makes me want to be sure of what is going to happen. The anxious and controllingness is rooted in my ego of me wanting to be assured that I will have enough. And so worry, Jesus is linking to our treasure. And he seems to be suggesting that when we worry, we are misplacing our treasure. He says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Not just your heart, not just your emotions and your feelings, but your core, your essence, your identity, who you are, the things that we value, the things that we pay attention to, the things that we focus on, those things that we give our resources and our attention, our mental bandwidth, our emotional bandwidth, those things that we give those things to, they become our treasure and they become our heart. They shape our heart. They shape who we are. They become the core of who we are. They do. We can't help it. It's the way we're made. That's the natural outcome. And whatever it is that we place at the core, whatever we give our attention to, that thing will become our treasure, and it will become our heart, and it will shape us, and it will make us. We are not merely products of our environment. We are products of our actions and our choices. What we do is shaped by what we value, and what we value, what is important to us, is shaped by what we give our intention to, what we invest in. Whatever you treasure will contain your heart and will become the core of your being. But where's God? If you, like me, tend to worry too much, especially about things that you and I cannot truly control, as a result, you and I spend far too much time shut up inside our heads. Inside our fears. And because you get stuck with your worries, on the other side of that door in your head, You're stuck in there with your worries, and so am I, worrying about what other people are going to think of me or you, or whether your responses are the correct or right, or whether you are good enough or will fit in, or will you ever receive the love and care and acceptance that you long for? The same love and care that you can't receive, that I can't receive. Why? Because I'm so distracted by the red herring of whether or not I deserve it, whether or not I deserve to be loved. And as a result of all this swirling around, what happens is we miss the present moment. Perhaps you, like me, tend far too often check out of the here and now and miss the present moment. Worry does that to us. And if we don't focus, if we do focus on the things we worry about, they're either things that happened in the past or they're things we're afraid are going to happen in the future. And they are not here and now. They're not here with us. They're not in this moment. And ironically, that's where God will meet us. God meets us in the present moment. He meets us here and now. That's really the primary place where God meets us. But we spend so much of our energy pulled out of this present moment, checked out. The past is locked up and gone, and the future is always just over there somewhere. It isn't here. This present moment is brought to you by God. The same God who created the universe and all things in it. The same God who will be there at the end of time. The God who spills over before the beginning and after the end. Who was and is to come. But the only place that we experience God is here and now. And this here and now moment is the place where God will meet us. This is where we encounter God. This moment now. And so, I would like to invite us all. This is where we take a moment. No. We are given a moment to let go of our worries and to reinvest our attentiveness in the God who loves us, the God who looks at us and sees only his beloved. And we do not do this because we are good enough. We're not. Not because we did our best. We didn't. Not because we're worthy. Whatever that means. Not because everyone can see our great acts and our sacrificial charity, nor because they hear our eloquent prayers. Or they just can't tell, or they can just tell by looking at us what deeply spiritual people we are. Not any of that. Because they don't know what a mess we are. I've known people who were perfect. I just didn't know them very well. And this God who invites us into this moment, who is righteousness, in his righteousness, this God makes the sun shine on the righteous and the unrighteous. This generous God who in his generosity makes the rain fall on the just and on the unjust, on the good and the bad, on the good enough and the not good enough. To be alone for a moment with God who sees us for who we truly are, who looks past who we think we are, to the heart of each of us, and who only longs with all that he has and all that he is, longs to be with us in this moment.